Chapter 4. A.R., I discovered, was none other than Arnold Rothstein, the gambler reputed to have fixed the 1919 World Series. Although he made a pretty bundle on the series, he'd simply followed the smart money. When he saw the betting shift to Cincinnati against the favored Chicago White Sox, he knew the fix was in. A thick-set, well-mannered man, he spoke and dressed like a banker. His cheeks were chalky, and his forehead deeply creased at the junction of the eyebrows and nose. He kept his shiny black hair slicked back and parted on the left. Most striking were his large, soft brown eyes, which narrowed whenever he felt he'd been cheated. Women must have found him exciting. I did, but I wanted to tell him to trim the black hairs that grew from his nose. On the drive south through the Skeeter State, I talked a blue streak. About Pop's dying, and Uncle Sam and Mom's isolation, and my lucky silver dollar Babe Ruth gave me, and my fear of dead birds, and Charles Courtney and Lily, and why I was named Henrietta. What I said must have sounded funny because A.R. frequently laughed, and yet he seemed awfully distant, hardly speaking at all. When I'd run out of things to say, I asked him why he'd engineered my escape. You have to lay low until the bust and the robbery are out of the papers. In the meantime, I'll get you Bill Fallon. He's the best mouthpiece in America. I knew the popular slogan, "Get Fallon and go free," but I knew too that Lamsters have a tough time proving their innocence. What a mess! Harry had also promised to get me a lawyer. How could I possibly explain all this to him and my mother? A.R. must have sensed my concern because he asked, "What's eating you?" When I explained, he told me that numerous times he'd been in serious trouble himself, and Fallon had invariably managed to spring him. But I knew from the papers that Arnold Rothstein never helped anyone unless there was a payback. "I still don't understand why you took an interest in me." "I hate injustice. I can smell it a mile away. You saw me trying to talk Sully out of taking you in. I could tell you were going to be framed." "What's in it for you?" I brazenly asked, not for one second believing his line. "I have a big heart, Henny. Everyone says the same thing. You need money or a fix or some other kind of help, C.A.R. I listened and worried. The last hour of the drive, we sat in silence. The morning light dispelled the darkness. As we approached Vineland, vegetable and dairy farms began to appear, and orchards and feedlots. Although a sign said that Vineland covered 68 square miles, it looked to me as if the whole town could fit easily into five. The chauffeur turned into a street called Delsey Drive, drove a short distance, and pulled up under a great copper beech glowing purple and red in the morning sun. Removing two bags from the trunk, one leather, one cardboard, the chauffeur put the first in front of the house and the other under his arm, saying he'd find a place to stay down at the train yard. The hideout was certainly no mansion. The paint had fled years ago, and the corrugated tin roof was more rust than metal. A porch ran across the front of the house and down one side. Met by a short, balding man in a vest with a gold chain stretched from one breast pocket to the other, I could see that the chain supported a lavalliere and that he also had a ring with the same insignia.
"I heard it went sour."
"Nathan," said A.R., "shake hands with Henrietta Fine. She's a pal of mine. Henny, this is Nathan Baritsky." As we shook, he asked, "What's a kid doing here?"
"She's working for me."
"I ain't got much room. Garah pulled up an hour ago."
A.R.'s neck muscles grew taut, and his voice dropped off to a venomous whisper. The plan was for him to return to the city and hang out in the Bronx. Mr. Baritsky took a handkerchief from his pocket and started dabbing his forehead.
"He said someone ratted. He said Vineland was safer.
The cops must have had a plan at the party, but that doesn't explain who got off with the rocks." Baritsky shrugged his shoulders, and throwing me an unfriendly look, led us inside. When I saw the furnishings and the rooms, a name came to mind: Castle Woe. On one side of the house were two bedrooms, separated by a bathroom. The mattresses, stuffed with rags, rested on rusty springs that squeaked so loudly that even the most passionate couples would have abstained. On the other side of the house, the rooms, front to rear, were the parlor, the sitting room, the dining room, the kitchen, and pantry. Garah had taken the back bedroom. I settled into the front one. In back of the house stood a chicken coop and a small forge where Nathan Baritsky plied his glass trade. An outsider could have been excused for thinking that the owner of this place was a homesteader. Garah's presence rankled A.R. Taking out a bankroll as fat as a fist, he peeled off some bills and told me to buy toothbrush and clothes. I took the hint. Since he wanted me out of the house, I'd do just as he suggested. Just walk down Dulcie Drive to Gordon's ready-to-wear store, 'cause they sell dirt cheap. On the road, I heard a flutter of fowls. Taking a gander, I could tell that someone was disturbing the birds in the ramshackle coop. I figured it must be a farmhand and went on my way. 2 hours later, I returned, having brought a number of things not at Gordon's, but at Arlen Norman's bargain store. A.R. and the jowly Garah were in the parlor hunched over, talking, no more than 6 inches apart. The parlor and sitting room furniture, I swear, dated from the Civil War. All the pieces, sofa, armchair, rocker, and four chairs, were covered in bilious green terry with piped backs. Come on in, Henny. I want you to meet Mr. Shapiro. Jacob Garah Shapiro had a reputation as a cold-blooded murderer who would scrag his own kid if the money was right. People who fought with him usually ended up dead. A hulking, hot-tempered, balloon-faced, loud-mouthed ignoramus who could hardly speak English, he was given the moniker Garah because whenever he wished to dismiss someone, he'd give a person a punch or a kick and shout, "Get out of here," meaning "get out of here." Mumbling something about a punk, he scowled and, twisting his lips contemptuously, made me feel I'd be dead by morning. He was shoeless, and his socks looked like silk. Juggling my packages, I put out my hand, which he grudgingly shook, excused myself, and went to my bedroom. A short time later, I returned to the parlor. "Sit down on the couch, Henny," said A.R. with particular kindness. "Jacob and I, we've been having a talk. You're a good egg, so I'll be perfectly frank. After the Waldo Avenue theft, Jacob brought the diamonds to Rodman's place and hid them in the fish tank for safekeeping. The Sicilians were to take possession of them once the booze was unloaded and counted. But when the cops interrupted Hank's party, Garah went to your room and found the diamonds missing." He paused to look at Garah. "Isn't that what you told me, Jacob?"
"Yeah, that's how it happened."
"Someone made off with 15 of them, leaving one behind, the one the cops found. Maybe Masseria will be willing to overlook the loss in exchange for hard cash." I wondered why A.R. would be telling me about the heist. Then it hit me. They thought I had the stuff. "You don't think I took the diamonds?" I gasped, knowing full well they did.
"Where is the gem stashed?"
asked the scowling Garah. "How would I know? They look to me like decorative stones for the fish."
"Ah!" shouted Garah, as if he'd just struck it rich. "Then you knew they were there."
Why did I open my trap? I began to run my fingers along the piping of the furniture, feeling the valleys and thinking, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." One thing I knew for certain, the guy who wrote that line wasn't sitting across from A.R. and Garah. "Remember in the car, Henny, you asked me why I came to your aid? Well, what I didn't say was that I had to know if you copped the jewels."
Jacob has got himself a point. The smell is the fella. You just said you knew they were in the fishbowl.
Gurah moved a Roscoe from inside his jacket and moved toward the door. Leaning against the jamb, he started spinning the cylinder, which was the only sound in the room. To this day, I can't explain why, but at that moment, sitting there, being accused of lifting their jewels, I heard myself say, "They're in the chicken coop." Gurah looked as if he'd sat on a needle.
"What the hell do you mean?"
"Go look for yourself," I said, hoping I'd have a chance to escape.
"Show us," said A.R.
"I'm allergic to feathers. Once was enough," I replied. A.R. called Nathan and told him to keep an eye on me while he and Gurah went to the coop. What began as a lark was becoming a goose chase.
Gurah started babbling. "I'm not happy. She comes in here like none of your business, and right out she says the ice is in the coop. I'm thinking, who would believe it? The coop is so far off the mark, there's no reason even to look."
He lit a cigar.
"I do not wish to get my shoes dirty in chicken shit, but I also do not wish for you to think I am picky. So if you do not mind the stink and the schmutz, we will take that stroll."
A.R. gave him a long look.
"Right. Get your shoes." "I'd rather go barefoot," he said, removing his socks, "than mess up my Oxfords."
"Okie cokely," A.R. snapped, using a favorite expression, and rudely pointed at me.
"Where in the coop?"
"In one of the nests, or maybe underneath. I was so nervous I can hardly remember." The two of them went out the back door. Mr. Baritsky was no conversationalist, nor was he a careless jailer. Each of my questions was met with a grunt, and he never budged from the door.
"Lived here long?"
"Yeah."
"Like this part of the country?"
"Yeah."
"You part of the gang?"
"No."
On their return, A.R., shoeless, told Gurah to wash off his feet. Then he nodded to Mr. Baritsky to take a powder.
"My hat goes off to you, Henny. Smart move putting the rocks in the nesting straw. We recovered them."
I was so scared and surprised, a trickle of pee escaped, wetting my pants. A.R. was cradling a handkerchief with a number of diamonds. Drawn to their pale blue radiant light, I lifted one up and rolled it round in my palm. Just this sparkler, I knew, could put Mom and me on Easy Street.
"I'd rather have this than the booze," I said. "So would Masseria and Zucanier."
Handing A.R. the diamond, I fixed my eyes on his.
"Are you going to croak me?"
A.R. just laughed. He nodded and pocketed the hanky. Out of the corner of his mouth, he said confidentially, "I want you to do me a favor."
"Glad to," I gushed, grateful that I hadn't been topped.
"Outside, we'll talk. Come on." Telling Gurah that we'd be back in a shot, a phrase that wobbled my knees, he took me by the arm, opened the front door, and led me down the road, past a road sign pointing to Carmel. We walked, saying nothing. The air, heavy and hot, buzzed with insects. I began sweating. Was it the heat or my fears? What happened next nearly caused me to faint. A.R. put his arm on my shoulder and gave me an affectionate squeeze.
"I knew you were clean because you had no way to get the stuff out, unless you swallowed it or... but you're not that kind of girl."
"You sure had me worried."
"I was trying to smoke out that four flusher. But you were no chump. You had him pegged."
"How did you know?"
"Know what?"
I wasn't about to tell him it was just a wild stab, so in hopes of buying some time, I said nothing. Finally, the silence grew so loud, I had to reply.
"Well, the one thing I can tell you is I'm no fortune teller. The proof was right there."
"Smart kid," he said. "You noticed too."
I had no idea what he meant, but as long as he figured I did, I decided to play right along.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious.
Who would have thought?
Did anything else make you suspicious? I asked, trying to figure out his thinking.
Yeah, him saying he couldn't stand the stink and the schmutz. In his whole life, Garah never visited a chicken coop. So how would he know, unless he'd just gone in there to hide the stuff?
My feelings exactly.
His shoes were probably in the other room covered with bird crap.
That's my guess.
Henny, you're a real smart kid. I like brains. That's what they call me on the boulevard, the brain. We ought to hook up. I can use someone who's good around locks. The only Madden gang has a kid. He climbs through heating vents and transoms and easily gets lost in a crowd. I'll go only one better. I'll use a girl. Who's going to look twice at you?
I didn't know how to take that last comment, so I just let it slide.
Now about that favor.
I couldn't imagine what he would ask for. On the one hand, I owed him for helping me slip the leash and for not rubbing me out. But on the other hand, I didn't want to get thick with A.A.R. and his friends.
Maziria and Zucanier are waiting for the diamonds. I want you to be the new paymaster. You'll have the stones tomorrow after Nathan cleans and polishes them real nice. I'll tell Zucanier he can collect from you here at Baritsky's. Garah and I will return to the city together in the same car. That way, the rotten double-crosser won't get in your hair.